This is the Law and the Future of War podcast, brought to you from the University of Queensland Law School. Through conversation with experts in technology, law and military affairs, this series explores how international law regulates new military technologies.
There are a number of challenges that the introduction of autonomy creates when it comes to international humanitarian law and international law compliance. As part of our series on the Legal Review of Autonomous Weapon Systems, or AWS, we're speaking with two researchers on the practicalities of how to define and limit this obligation, and if it's even technically possible. In particular, we'll be exploring how the obligation applies to decision support systems and also focusing in on how the review obligation could be approached during the design and development phases in the creation of autonomous weapon systems. Claudia Karnowska is a PhD candidate in international law at the ASSA Institute in the University of Amsterdam. She studies the interactions of humans and AI-enabled decision support systems in military decision-making processes and the consequences to the compliance of military practices with international humanitarian and human rights law. She's a member of the research project Designing International Law and Ethics into Military Artificial Intelligence, or DILEMMA. Taylor Kate Woodcock is also a PhD researcher in public international law at the ASSA Institute and University of Amsterdam. Her research, conducted in the context of the DILEMMA project, examines implications of development and use of military applications of AI for current international legal frameworks governing armed conflict. In particular, she's looking at the relationship between the legal frameworks and concepts of human agency and looking for how that can be taken into account during the design of AI and infrastructures in which the algorithms are embedded. Thank you, Claudia, and thank you, Taylor, for joining us. Thanks, Claudia.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
And thank you, Taylor, for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to join you today for this conversation.
So we'll start with Claudia. We've discussed the concept of legal review of weapons, means and methods of war in other podcasts, but could you remind our listeners what the Article 36 obligation is all about?
Yes, of course. Thank you, Lauren, for the question. So Article 36, to start with, is embedded in Additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions. And to summarize what the obligation says is that state parties should conduct a legal review of so-called new weapons, means, or methods of warfare, importantly, before they are employed. In other words, also, we could say that it requires states to make sure that the systems that they use and also how they use them are compliant with international law. And it seems clear from kind of the outset, or seems straightforward, but actually increasingly we see that reviewing new weapons, means and methods of warfare really creates a lot of challenges. I would say that on the one hand, we can think of these legal challenges, right? So clarifying what the terms are, what the scope of these terms is. So what are new weapons, means and methods of warfare? But also on the technical side, we have new challenges as well. And so, you know, algorithms are highly complex. It's sometimes difficult to know exactly how such algorithms work and also how they react to new data and new operational environments. It also creates the challenge of lawyers knowing how to review such algorithms when they lack technical knowledge, and also whether they actually should have the knowledge to review code, so to say. So those are some of the practical challenges. But also maybe more broadly, I think from my perspective, the Article 36 review really creates this before and after moment, where the assumption is that there is a before moment, before the review, when the weapon, means, or methods of warfare are still in the study, acquisition, or development, and therefore are being reviewed. And the after moment, when it's assumed that because they have already been reviewed, they're now legal, they're now lawful in the eyes of the law and depend now on how they're used. But with machine learning algorithms that are continuously changing, and especially learning from new environments, that really changes the dynamic of the before and after moment, and new questions arise in that regard.
Hayley, did you want to make any comments about identifying exactly where that moment sits?
Yeah, so I think this is the tricky part about these technologies, and really highlights how the use of these sorts of technologies is so tied up with the design, and that it is difficult to try to separate those things, and that this sort of use is what we need to consider as part of the review process as well.
Claudia, your research deals primarily with how this legal review could apply to decision support systems. Could you explain for our listeners what a decision support system is and how it might become a weapon, means, or method of warfare, noting what Taylor has just said about that concept of use?
Yeah, so indeed, in my research, I focus on decision support systems. And what I mean by that is software applications that are not embedded in, for example, weapons or platforms that have direct connection to physical capabilities, but are rather software applications that we can imagine sitting on a computer, so to say, that to a certain extent help us to analyze information that we receive and provide recommendations on what to do with that information. There are plenty of examples of how decision support systems are used in the military, with systems that are there to recommend best courses of action, or maybe certain algorithms that are used to identify objects in the environment that the military is finding themselves in. And so the reason why I'm interested in decision support systems is because they're really highly influential on the military decision-making processes. That's actually also what they're designed for in the first place, right? They are there to speed up the processes. They're there to find the proverbial needles in the haystack and there to alleviate some of the burdens of the humans. And so really taking seriously this idea that they're influencing how we make decisions is something that led me to consider the importance of reviewing them under Article 36 review, or processes that are there to prevent states from using systems that could lead to unlawful conduct of hostilities. And so it's definitely important to consider, you know, from the legal perspective, how DSS become weapon, means, or methods of warfare would be a question of how do we interpret DSS to be part of the scope of the review. And I'm not the only author to suggest that there is definitely scope to interpret this provision to mean that other systems other than weapons could be used, could be reviewed, and should be reviewed. But also pragmatically, we can think of it as, you know, in terms of what the objective of the Article 36 is in itself. And if the objective is to prevent states from using such systems that would be used unlawfully, then definitely decision support systems are an important thing to consider.
So this is broader than the traditional approach to weapons reviews, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And you can see how even the way we speak about Article 36 influences our way of thinking about it, right? Oftentimes we don't say Article 36 review, we say weapons review. But definitely Article 36 is broader than that. And I think especially today, it's time to think of new technologies of warfare that influence military conduct.
So you talk about influence of military conduct. Taylor, did you want to jump in on that?
Maybe just to add that current debates on military technologies really tend to focus on the question of autonomous weapon systems. But this issue of decision support is a really important one, because in the short term, there are far less obstacles to militaries integrating these sorts of algorithms to support decision making. And for some militaries, this is already reality. We know that the Gotham system developed by the company Palantir is a really good example of an AI-powered system that is used to improve and accelerate decisions for operators in all sorts of roles and also across domains. So this question of decision support is really pressing and should be taken up in international debates.
So Claudia, how do you define what is captured then to link it closely enough to the intent of Article 36? So you've written about the concept of co-production of hostilities. Is that your measure? Is that your sort of line in the sand as to what should be included in reviews or shouldn't?
Yeah, so it's very important for us to make our considerations about decision support systems practical for what later lawyers in the legal review process will have to review. Of course, we can't review all systems, and perhaps it's also not practical. So the concept of co-production really helps to highlight two things. So on the one hand, co-production focuses on the product that is developed together, but because of this term of co-production, we also have this idea that there are different entities that together, through the work, how they work, how they interact, they create something, in this case, the product. And I was thinking of a good way for our listeners to understand what I mean by co-production. And I think that the term of co-authorship, which is also an example of co-production, is a good way to think of it. You know, we can think of articles, papers, music pieces, or even podcasts that are co-produced by more than one person. And so in the way that we interact in the discussion, in the way that we engage together, we create a product that would have been different if one of us would not have been in it. And of course, there are many technologies that help us to do it, right? I mean, we're using audio recorders, we're using other technologies to help us distribute the work. And we would not consider all technologies to be part of the co-authorship or the co-production of the podcast. But also, it is not difficult to imagine that systems like, for example, ChatGPT or other systems that would change the content of our discussions and also, in a sense, exchange with us through ideas would be considered to be co-authors in this process. So the same goes for the military. There are many decision support systems that can be used in the process of running the military in general. There are many of them that are used and will increasingly be used in the future. But if we think of what I call co-production of the conduct of hostilities, then there's more clearer line of which technologies really help to help or contribute to this final outcome of what is happening on the ground, which at the end is what IHL is concerned with. So this really helps us to delineate the amount of technologies that would fall under the review.
So you mentioned IHL's concern in terms of the conduct of hostilities and the lawful conduct of hostilities. So how do you link that concept of co-production of hostilities with IHL rules?
Yeah, so that's what I mean with the co-production of the conduct of hostilities. At the end of the day, with the legal review, of course, the IHL norms is only part of the review, right? We're also thinking of other ways that weapons or other systems and technologies of warfare can per se be unlawful. And it's important to consider all of them. Decision support systems themselves, of course, may not be even designed to make the final decision, or they might not even be designed to make a recommendation of what is proportional or not. But just the fact that they frame questions and recommendations in a certain way, that they highlight the amount of combatants over civilians and how they frame the questions of who is a combatant or who is a civilian, those things are really important already in the design, as Taylor mentioned before. And it's really important to think of how these technologies down the line contribute to the lawfulness of actions of the military.
So speaking of lawfulness of technologies then, what does legality mean when we're considering the design of new technologies? What legal frameworks are taken into account? Taylor, I wonder if I could throw that to you first and then back to Claudia, please.
This question of legality is a really foundational one, Lauren, and it really, in debates so far, has tended to be framed in terms of whether AI technologies and algorithms can replace human beings. And this question of whether AI can be more compliant with international humanitarian law when compared to how humans implement international humanitarian law. For example, the question is posed, could machines make better distinctions of combatants and civilians on the battlefield than people could? But this sort of comparison is problematic in a couple of different ways. The first is that it's not really possible to compare the performance of AI directly with the performance of people when it comes to legality and implementing international humanitarian law. The fact is, based on the current state of the art of technologies, machine learning algorithms do different things than people do. And we need to be really clear on exactly what these technologies can do. If we're looking at machine learning, this really engages in pattern matching and classification based on patterns in historical data, which is very different from the sorts of legal reasoning that people do. And, you know, it's also not necessarily an appropriate question of asking if these technologies can perform better than humans, because ultimately the responsibility to implement IHL on the battlefield rests with the military commander.
And also to add to this, there are also challenges of separating the humans from technologies themselves, right? The type of questions that Taylor mentions in terms of comparison of humans and technologies assumes that either one of them would be acting on its own. And we have seen that increasingly how the military conducts hostilities is not performed in this way. Humans are no longer acting on their own. They're using technologies everywhere they go, and those technologies really contribute to their way of thinking and framing responses in armed conflict. But also the same for the technologies. They are not independent from the way that we design them and how we use them. And that perhaps also leads us to what we've, with Taylor, we have been thinking about in terms of how to differently frame these questions of legality, right? So on the one hand, I would say that legality means much more what human machine practices kind of come to be, how they evolve, and how humans and technologies together change the way that the military conducts hostilities.
So going back to, I guess, the comments about the responsibility for IHL resting with the commander and then the legal standards that we're applying to machines, is it a question then of performance or testing of these systems and understanding how they might be implemented rather than this sort of anthropomorphization of suggesting we're inserting machines instead of humans? I mean, I think the debate's probably gone past that sort of concept, but we still struggle with translating the idea of legal compliance when we're doing the reviews of machines that are doing some of the work that humans used to. Can you comment on that at all?
Absolutely. So I think a useful way to think about it, particularly when it comes to these sorts of decision support systems, is whether the use of these sorts of technologies place military commanders and other military actors in a position to continue to fulfill IHL obligations. And often there's a tendency to think about IHL in terms of the fact that it governs the effects of hostilities. But I think it's also important to consider that one of the way that it does that is also to look at how decision-making is made in military operations. And, you know, there are certain legal standards, like, for instance, precautionary principle under IHL or the proportionality principle, that really require commanders to engage in reasonable decision-making. And, you know, this can't just be determined based on the effects of the attack. So it's really important to come back to this question of exactly how humans and machines interact and this sort of co-production of hostilities, as Claudia has aptly put it, to consider whether these technologies allow people to continue to fulfill their legal obligations.
So how does that translate into practical issues when you're designing these kinds of technologies?
So it's really this question, I think, of thinking about how can we design not just technologies as instruments that we use, but these sort of socio-technical infrastructures where it's also the people who are involved in using them, and how can this element also be considered in the design process, and what sort of capabilities are afforded to people through the use of AI technologies like decision support systems, for example. And asking this question of, well, how can technologies be designed to really account for human-machine interactions? It's not an easy one. And we really need to consider the use of the technologies and the different operational contexts in which they're used, the people that are relying on them, and how they will understand these technologies, how they will treat them as part of design processes.
So when we link that back to the Article 36 obligation, we're talking about a much broader review process than is currently undertaken for, say, conventional weapons, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with these technologies, there is a need to go beyond sort of, as Claudia put it, this before and after moment, and really consider these technologies and how they're used. And that's not an easy thing to do. There are a number of, I think, characteristics of machine learning algorithms, for instance, that make the testing process itself very difficult. You know, we're talking about algorithms that are referred to as black boxes, that they're opaque. And even for computer scientists, it's very difficult to try to understand the decision logic of a system. And this raises a lot of important questions about how do we go about verifying and validating these sorts of algorithms throughout review processes. And I think this does pose a number of new challenges that we haven't necessarily had to face in review processes before.
So with that concept of after moment then, I mean, is that a longer line in time now, Claudia? Is it less easy to pinpoint when the review's been done with?
Yeah, I think something that we're struggling with to see the difference between a review as a process that kind of gets its own, you know, stamp, it's been approved, and then it goes on to be used, and seeing the review as a process that is ongoing with the lawyers that have this capacity to review systems, to be involved in also the deployment process, and which is also the development process for the systems that are continuously learning. And in a sense, we could say that it also blurs the line a little bit between Article 36 review and Article 82 with the legal advisors that are supposed to be there also to help the commanders to make lawful decisions. And we see that increasingly with algorithms, it might be necessary to have this more iterative and frequently repeated process.
How practical do you both think this is in terms of
being able to undertake an ongoing review or have very limited legal resources doing this more than once or considering it as an iterative response? I mean, states don't really do this even if they're obliged to as it is. Do we think making this system more complicated is going to see other kinds of challenges in the review process?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge seeing already now how difficult it is to make states oblige with this provision. But I think that we should really strive to go in that direction. And I'm careful to say that, you know, just because the process will be more iterative, it will take necessarily much more resources. I think that there's a way to adapt to it and learn how to do it in an efficient way. But it's something that I think we're learning as we're also learning how to ask the right questions to the technical developers of the systems. The same way that the technical people are learning how to adapt to what the military needs. And I think as we're developing these, you know, kind of the language in which we talk about these technologies, it will also help us to make this review process more efficient in the future.
Taylor, did you have thoughts on that?
Given that states are investing huge amounts of money, time, and resources into the development of military applications of AI, there is to some extent already this investment taking place, and to sort of channel some of that into legal review as part of design and development processes that are already happening is not such a far jump. Given that these tests are probably taking place anyway, why not ask the legal question as an integrated part of that?
Which circles back to something that you said, Claudia, earlier about the idea that lawyers might need to understand code to be able to conduct these reviews with this new technology. I mean, there's challenges with translating legal obligations like what the standard for due diligence in precautions is going to be into an algorithm in the first instance. Do we think that's a reasonable expectation of lawyers as well?
Yeah, so I think the modern lawyer does need to have some new skills when it comes to reviewing these processes. And, you know, I don't foresee that in this context, lawyers are going to need to be able to understand the details and specificities of the code itself. And I think there are already a lot of technologies that are complex that are used in a military setting where the people using those technologies don't necessarily know the minute details of how it functions. But I think there are some key things that do need to be understood by people engaging in reviews of these technologies and also people seeking to rely on these technologies. And part of this is understanding the decision logic of an algorithmic system. Why does it produce the output that it does? And what are the reasons behind that? And I think there is a huge challenge in the lack of explainability of the current state of the art of machine learning that really raises a lot of questions and causes a lot of problems for this sort of understanding. And I think this is an area that, you know, there's a lot of research into explainable AI, and this is really necessary in order to be able to understand these technologies for review purposes.
That's a good point, because I think there is a bit of a, you know, a pushback in some areas saying that it doesn't have to be transparent, it just needs to be predictable rather than necessarily explainable. Do either of you have thoughts about that in when we're talking about IHL compliance, particularly when we're thinking about IHL obligations that focus on result rather than necessarily intent?
I think to some extent, the predictability of these systems is related to the explainability of the systems. It's not necessarily an either-or question, because in order to be able to predict how a system might operate in a new context, you really need to be able to understand, at least to some extent, the decision logic behind the system. And given that there are obstacles to explainability of these systems, I don't think they're necessarily as separate issues.
For me, the questions of explainability and also predictability are a little bit more linked to what we then see in terms of the practice of the military. How does a system that, for example, provides us a lot of information about how it analyzes the data influence our ability to then later implement those decisions, right? If that consumes a lot of time of the analyst, and then the analyst anyways ignores all of that information and then the decision still is influenced by the system, then it doesn't really change much, right? And so I think there's a lot of different ways that people are trying to design those systems so that there's maybe like different levels of explanation that the analyst can go into. Maybe the interface itself is a bit more simple. But I think at the end of the day, it depends on how the military designs the practice of it and what kind of safeguards they design and how they train their people to really interact with it. And that kind of practice that they build around the systems, not only the design of it, will really, at the end of the day, influence how they implement IHL norms.
Taylor, you research how technologies can be designed with legal considerations in mind. So based on, you know, our discussion so far, if the review obligation applies to design and development of weapons, means and methods of warfare, how can different design approaches incorporate those legal considerations? Or is it even possible to design a weapon with legal considerations in mind?
Yeah, I think this is a really important question. And I think one that the debate really needs to shift towards. And, you know, when we consider how effective international law can be moving forward to govern these sorts of technologies, we really need to try to identify specific tensions that might arise when particular applications are used. And, you know, it's not necessarily going to be the case that international law can be formalized in an algorithmic format. But, you know, we should really consider that when it comes to these technologies, one, there's a question of whether they're fit for purpose and if they can be used with a specific application in mind. And two, whether there are risks that we can mitigate through design. And when we go through legal review in the design process, we might already find out that these systems prevent international legal obligations from being implemented. And on this basis, that might be a reason that they're not fit for purpose. Alternatively, we might find out, well, there are certain risks, you know, if it comes to predictability, explainability, or biases, and try to find ways of mitigating these risks throughout the design processes. And I think these are all really important questions that need to be considered already at the design stage, because if we wait till use to try to figure all this out, then at some point it's too late.
So circling back to a comment that, Claudia, you made at the start, which is the idea of understanding context and use, and then, you know, layering that on, Taylor, to what you're talking about that obligation to think about how to design with those legal issues in mind. How does that change the way the review is going to be undertaken? What additional steps are required? Are there additional steps? Is there more information needed? Other than more iterative approach, how does this change the legal review landscape?
Yeah, I mean, talking from the perspective of academics that have little practical view of what these legal processes really look like, because so little is known about them, what I think is important is to see the expertise that is involved in the reviews. It seems that this is something that will shift increasingly towards technical, but we have seen that this shift has also happened in terms of other expertises of health or environment that needed to be included in the processes. So the technical seems to be an important one that will have to be included. Probably the other shift is the frequency of these reviews, although we see that states are still reluctant to, you know, it's something that's very difficult because even with the question of what is a new algorithm and when does the algorithm become new, it all seems to be very arbitrary. So making it effective, making it easy to understand when these processes have to happen is something that we will still struggle with for some time. So these are some of the shifts that I think we have highlighted and will probably require states to adapt their processes.
I did want to throw a bit of a curveball question in then. So, you know, we're talking about this idea of having AI subsume some functions that humans would have made in the decision-making process. So we're not saying that the machines are making the decisions entirely, but there's been a design decision at some point to delegate some legislative assessment process to a machine. Are we seeing that in other areas? Have we seen other sectors successfully translate legislative obligations to AI?
So this question of translating the law into code is certainly one that's actually been happening for a really long time. And it's not just limited to the military context, but to law and legal practices more broadly. And there are a lot of questions about to what extent we can have this sort of artificial judge acting as someone deciding legal cases. And there are specific examples of decisions around parole, for example, when algorithms have been used to sort of provide recommendations about whether or not someone should be granted parole. And there are a lot of debates more broadly about, well, what sort of legal rules, standards, and principles can algorithms be used for, and what will they be useful for? And this is all really important background context to think about in debates on military AI. We don't have to reinvent the wheel, but we should consider what's already been happening in these debates. And, you know, I think a really good distinction that we can draw from this is from the form of legal regulations. You know, when it comes to legal rules that are quite objective, can be applied in sort of a straightforward manner, like a speed limit, then this sort of thing is something that may well be more amenable to being programmed into algorithmic systems. But when we look at legal standards, for example, there are a lot more questions about the feasibility of this, because legal standards are not something that can be determined sort of objectively, but really it's decision-making to a certain standard. And in the context of military AI, a really good example of this is proportionality, that we don't determine proportionality by purely looking at the results of an attack, but we look at the decision-making process that led up to that attack and whether or not the commander acted reasonably with the information that was available to them at the time. And using this understanding of proportionality as a legal standard means that we can understand that, in a sense, IHL does regulate decision-making processes, and it's not just about the effects. And in this sense, delegating legal reasoning to standards may well not be feasible compared to legal rules.
That's a really great point. I mean, I know the French have outlawed any AI judicial decision-making just altogether.
I think it's important to really understand what the technology does in order to understand why it's not equivalent to human legal judgments. And when it comes to machine learning, these algorithms generate output by drawing on groupings of correlations of variables that it identifies from training data. And these patterns then form the basis of predictions that new input may or may not match these sort of correlations and patterns identified. And this is quite different from the really contextual case-by-case decision-making that's required for something like a proportionality assessment, because of the heavy reliance on patterns in training data and the fact that these algorithms can't extrapolate outside of these past examples. Proportionality really has an inherently qualitative dimension, and this is not something that's necessarily measurable in terms of algorithmic code, which is really quantifiable things. And proportionality assessments also require human lives to be valued. And in this sense, this legal standard has a really moral dimension to it. And it's really difficult to try to understand whether or not algorithms can account for that aspect of this decision-making process. So I think these sorts of characteristics of proportionality assessments really show why the use of a machine learning algorithm might not be fit for purpose in this context.
So do you think that comes down to limitations on what each capability can do, as opposed to tasking an AI with the entire task, the entire decision-making process? Because, I mean, as it stands now, contemporary militaries delegate small parts of the decision-making process to a number of different people in the system. And is there a risk that we are asking too much, or we think in our brains that the AI is going to be doing everything?
I think it comes back to the tendency that we were trying to highlight with Taylor at the beginning in terms of the comparisons of humans and technologies, right? On one hand, we could say, okay, we're vesting too much hope in what the systems will do and maybe think that there's some level of autonomy that we can compare. But at the end of the day, the Article 36 review also itself assumes that we can take this technology out of the entire infrastructure in which it will later function and how it will be used and the humans that it will be connected to and also other technologies that it will be connected to, and to independently assess its legal use. And so it's very challenging to do it this way. And so there's one kind of warning sign is that, yes, we should not assess them as separate entities. We should always think of how they contribute to this co-production of hostilities. And in that co-production, will they help us or help us as states conduct hostilities in a lawful way? And then there's the second warning sign, so to say, to legal reviewers, to say, you know, don't compare technologies with humans one-on-one, right? As Taylor suggests, like, there's so many different elements of how technologies and humans conduct, for example, a proportionality assessment, that we cannot just say, okay, who does it better, so to say, right? It's really important to look at what kind of consequences it has if we do it this or another way, and how together the outcome of these processes will influence states' conduct.
So just back to Taylor then about that review of technologies concept, how broadly do you think practically you need to look at the system then? So, you know, the AI is part of a broader system. Does there need to be an understanding of how the AI is going to function within that system? Is it possible to just review the AI as a piece of software in a particular context in and of itself? How does that work?
I think you've pointed to the real difficulty because, you know, we're talking about algorithms as if they're discrete applications. But the reality is that there can be many algorithms integrated into a broader system. And, you know, the input of one algorithm can feed off input from another, and also human decisions that are integrated within the systems. And so when it comes to reviewing, a question is, well, can you really effectively review one isolated algorithm without considering the broader system that it's integrated into? Given the complexity of algorithms and AI technologies, this is a new challenge that we face, that, of course, military decision making is already distributed, it's already complex, but this really adds a significant layer of complexity and diffusion to these processes. And, you know, I don't have a good answer to this, but I think it's definitely worthy of closer attention and debates.
Well, thank you so much for those views on some of those complexities. I think you've really drawn out just how challenging this review process is going to be when we're thinking about autonomy in systems for military use, and really useful to focus on where it's being done, or where autonomy has been successfully able to be applied in some legal contexts elsewhere. If you wanted to get smart on either the decision support system legal issues, or the review of decision support systems, or actually just the general technological challenges to reviews, what would you recommend to our listeners?
Thank you for this question. I think what we could highlight definitely is some of the resources that our project Dilemma has created so far. We've already been working on this topic for over 3 years. So there's a lot that we have produced, including questions of Article 36 review, but our group has also produced more broadly work on how to translate some of the IHL norms into computational code, whether and how it's possible or not, questions of philosophy of technologies and humans, but also state responsibility and criminal responsibility. So we can definitely direct listeners to our website, acer.nl/dilemma, where you can find a lot of our resources there.
And that's Dilemma with one M.
We'll put a link to it in our show notes. Did you have any other resources you wanted to reference, other than, of course, your articles, which we will put in there as well?
We've also been thinking about global governance of AI in the military domain a bit more broadly, more from sort of a policy perspective. And we produced a statement on that, which sort of covers what we think in our project are key issues for considering how military AI can be governed under the framework of international law, but also considering other more technical issues and ethical issues. And so that statement is also available on the Dilemma site.
Thank you so much for your time this evening and for this really great discussion.
Thank you, Lauren, for the invitation.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
This podcast was made by the Law and the Future of War Research Group at the University of Queensland Law School. A full list of episodes and links to additional material, as well as our contact details, are available on our website. Just search for Law and the Future of War. This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present.